Tonight on Arena, photographer Rich Gilligan on his life in New York and Blanchardstown, and Roxana Silbert and Stuart Graham on the new production of King Lear at the Gate Theatre. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena from photographing the skateboarders in the streets of Dublin to Hollywood's biggest name. Rich Gilligan has always been drawn to themes of belonging, identity and coming of age. His latest exhibition, The First Draft, marks a return to those themes, bringing his journey full circle as he showcases new work at Dreacht in Blanchardstown. The show blends still and moving images in what Gilligan himself refers to as expanded photography. This career has taken him from underground skate culture to the streets of New York to intimate portraits of figures like Cillian Murphy, Saoirse Ronan and Barry Keoghan. Delighted to be joined in studio this evening by Rich Gilligan. Back to the future. That's where it all started, Rich, I believe.
That's where it all kicked off. Yeah, well, that was where I guess my fascination with skateboarding kicked off, which then in time and over time led to an interest in photography.
Yeah, when did that? Because, I mean, you were growing up in Coolmine in and around, what, the 80s and 90s, was it?
Yeah, I missed seeing Back to the Future 1 in the cinema. I definitely went to Back to the Future 2 for a birthday, but it would have been VHS, then Extravision, and convincing my folks to
allow you watch
to watch Marty McFly tear around on the back of a Jeep.
And were you much of a skateboarder yourself in and around the streets of your the estate where you were living?
Yeah, probably the only one at that time.
But do you still skateboard?
I do indeed. Yeah, I built a ramp this year that I have in my garden in Wicklow. So I'm not as nimble as I was, but definitely still rolling.
There you go. And some people stop at a certain point in time, but you're keeping it going. That is obviously the interest in skateboarding. Totally understandable for a young fellow growing up in suburban Dublin in the 80s and 90s. Back to the Future being a big part of that for lots of people at that time, let's face it. But when then did photography start to become a thing and skateboarding one of the major themes? Certainly in the early work, I think it was very important, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was kind of the only subject matter I was interested in. So when I suppose when I first picked up a camera or had the inkling to try and create images, I had no real interest in photography. I was interested in skateboard photography. So for me, at that time in a pre-internet age, it was magazines, and that was how I kind of discovered the culture. So it was really looking at photographs in magazines like Thrasher from San Francisco and RAD from the UK. I would look at these images and just be fascinated about the clothes people wore and the graphics that was on people's boards. And I guess because I realized I was never going to turn pro, I also was like, here's a way I can like explore this subculture and maybe like get myself in the room somehow.
Yeah. And what's interesting about, I suppose, skateboarding as, because these are still photographs, in inverted commas, still photographs. But I'm going to tweet a picture from 2002, which I think is part of the exhibition, The First Draft being the name of the exhibition. This is Paul Tremor, 2002, at RTE Arena, if you want to see this this image of Rich Gilligan's. You saw the images from LA, you saw the images from different cities in England, but you wanted to give, here's the Irish version of that. And this, anybody looking at the image now, it's, I presume it's a public toilet or it's a bath of some
kind. It's a public bathroom right on the seafront in Tremor.
In Tremor in County Waterford. And there's a guy, Paul, I presume.
Yeah, Paul McKean is his name.
Yeah, well, and still about, and you're still
aware? Skating. Paul lives in Madrid. He's a dub, another Northsider. But Paul, we've reconnected in doing the show. We ended up sending him the picture and... Yeah,
and it's a roof that has various, you know, diagonals and slants on it, which is perfect for skateboarding. Down one, up the other, and
it's
jump
actually
across.
Yeah, it's something that we had like been eyeing it up for years. There was a gang of like younger surfers and skaters because my dad's from Tremor, I would spend summers with my cousins there, and we would just look at this thing and be like, oh, someone could hit this, and then Paul was. Like he was a skater from Dublin, but he was sponsored and he was one of the best in the country at that time. And I'd started doing work for this English magazine, Sidewalk. So when we went there, it wasn't planned. Paul kind of like scaled up and like just started skating. And I think I shot like 10 frames and thankfully one of them worked. Mm. But
yeah, because this is a pre-internet age, it's pre-digital age.
Everything's analog.
Yeah, you were doing everything on film, black and white film as well at the time.
Processing all my film by hand and spending hours and hours in dark rooms, getting covered in probably really bad chemicals, but loved it.
And particularly with an image like the one we're looking at there, which gives us that, like, you really need to capture a moment in action. If he's too low on the board,
yeah,
there's no movement in it.
Yeah.
If he was flat on the roof, there's no movement in it. Is there an element of luck, or is there, does skill come into it and craft come into it as well?
Yeah, I mean, it is. There's craft in that, like, I mean, if you want to talk about like Henri Cartier-Bresson and the idea of the decisive moment, timing is really important, obviously. And it's 1/1000th of a second is what you need to be shooting at your shutter to freeze movement like that.
Wow.
So you're kind of like poised and ready to go, but you tune into it. And I guess, you know, in time you kind of get better at it. But I mean, don't get me wrong, I messed up like roll after roll of film, but thankfully it worked out this day.
And this is a question I've asked of many photographers. Is it essential actually to just be looking through the viewfinder? There's no point in having the camera down here saying, oh, there's a great shot, because by the time you get the camera up, it's gone.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because even now, though I shoot digitally, I still like to look through glass, and I still like the physicality of actually, you know, creating what exists within a frame and really thinking about just, you know, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of the kind of publications and iconic skate images I would have looked at, they were like blue skies in California or the mean streets of New York. But I was like, cool, this really looks like Ireland, and it's kind of grim, but also kind of beautiful in this like brutalist kind of architecture that was, they're actually gone. The toilets have been bulldozed.
It's a real shame because they...
but in a kind of full circle moment, they've built a really amazing concrete skate park literally on the
there
same...
There you go. You might maybe get in the 30, idea.
Well, 25 years later, so...
I want to take another picture from the exhibitionist before we get on to your move to New York and all of that, because Blanchardstown was obviously hugely formative and Cool Mine in those early years for you. I want to tweet a picture now called Fire Kids. This is a colour picture from a little bit later, to 2004. Actually, yeah. I thought it was going to be later than that. But what amazed me here is essentially three guys, is colour photographed this time, three guys sitting looking at a fire and another kid off and slightly in the distance, slightly off, out of focus. But somehow in this, despite the stillness, there's a sense of movement in there as well. Movement is clearly hugely important to you.
Yeah, I guess it's that idea of using images as ways to tell stories. I'm interested in storytelling. So this would have been made, this was with my first ever medium format camera. So essentially it's film, it's a Hasselblad camera that I'd gotten, but it was really like a way for me to work with this. Like I could kind of dip into this subculture and create these moments where I could have like a sense of drama, I suppose, is what I'm getting at. Or like the idea of creating something that felt cinematic in terms of like maybe it's slightly underexposed. So the flames draw you in, but it's actually quite dark in the foreground. But there's also this energy of people moving around and there's a sense of like anticipation.
And you're not lighting that. You're using the natural light of the fire.
No, it's just all
whatever you capture that.
That's actually probably the movement. It's like there's like slight bit of like camera shake or something. But for me, I'm
nervous
like,
that you're going to get something.
Yeah,
like that.
I'm never. I don't mind things technically not being perfect.
Yeah, it's if it has the right feel of it. So, and this exhibition in Drake kind of, I think to a large extent, looks back on those early pictures and looks back on that period in time. However, the move came to New York was 2015.
Yeah, yeah.
Avalanched that into being?
Yeah, kind of sheer determination, if I'm honest, because we had just, my daughter Robin, shout out to Robin, she was one at the time, she'd just been born. So everyone kind of was like, what, you can't move to New York with a 1-year-old. And we ended up getting, we sorted out all the visa stuff, which is a nightmare, but we The reason we went was I'd started to get a lot of work over there.
And what was the nature of that work, you know?
That would have been more commissioned work. So I guess a mix of lots of editorial portraiture with different artists and musicians and actors, and then also commercial work. So I would work for lots of brands and kind of like design agencies and music labels. So it just was really a place that beyond like professional development or whatever you want to call it, I've always been completely fascinated with New York City. And it's somewhere where, you know, a lot of the things, my core kind of like formative years of my interest in hip hop and like punk music and then skate culture, it's kind of like the epicenter of a lot of that stuff. And also photographically, you know, early work of like the likes of Nan Golden and Robert Frank. There's lots of artists whose work was maybe not even necessarily created there, but they were from there.
Yeah.
So it drew me in.
You felt you were going to the center of something or to an important place for this, for your particular art form. But I'm looking then, so 2015 was the time there, and here we are now, what, 10 years later?
Yeah, it's actually this month. I was just thinking about it today. So we left on the 28th of Feb, 2015.
So. Oh, wow. So you really are approaching that 10th anniversary. Do you divide the time equally between, you're saying Wicklow now is where you have the ramp out the back, presume that's where you're living. So is the time divided between Ireland and the US now, or how is it?
Pretty much full time in Ireland. Mm. We moved back 4 years ago, and I still have, like I'd still have an agent who represent me for commercial projects in the States. So I would generally go back once a year or whenever.
Do a bit of work or whatever.
So
when
stuff comes up, I bounce back and forth. But actually, it's been really busy here. And with everything working out with this exhibition, this has been like probably about 4 years of like slowly working on this, where when the commission came through Fingal, through the arts office there, getting this award. So the ARC Fingal, like that award that I got.
And how important was it, the getting of that? Like essentially a local award for you.
Yeah, it was huge. Like in terms of, I guess what I'm trying to get at is up until I got this award, it was very hard for me to allocate time to really concentrate on personal work.
Right.
And in terms of doing this exhibition.
And is it just the financial freedom to do it?
100%. Yeah, absolutely. So for me, I'm not like one of these people where I look down on my like commissioned work or my commercial work. For me, it all kind of feeds into the same practice. But equally, I know what it's like when it's kind of famine or a feast, where I can get so busy with commissions that ultimately personal work will take a back burner, despite your best intentions.
I'm looking at District Magazine here, where you're talking a lot about, you know, you're talking about your time going up to Easton on O'Connell Street, seeing that first copy of Thrasher. It's an article that kind of brings us through your journey through the photographic world. Some amazing portraiture in this. I'm looking at one right now, Barry Keoghan, one where he's kind of leaning back against a rock and laughing. Another where he's slightly off camera. Further down that page, Saoirse Ronan directly down the lens looking at us. And there's one further down, I think, of Timothy Chalamet. Kind of off into the distance. I'm not doing them justice in describing this. But what I found interesting, and I know you've photographed Cillian Murphy as well, when it comes to portraiture, you're still looking for that magic moment, I guess.
Totally.
What is the difference between that and the kind of the action photograph of the skateboard? How do you approach that as a photographer differently?
Yeah, I mean, in all honesty, I think part of my approach is that there is no difference. So whether I'm photographing someone on a roof they shouldn't be
on.
doing like skating, or, you know, it's this idea that, I guess it's like the energy you bring to someone when you create a portrait with them, it's kind of reflected back on you. So a lot of it would be just learning how to kind of like read the room and knowing like how to push and pull in terms of like, is this person really tired? Have we only got 5 minutes to create, you know, a cover shot and a double spread or whatever? So a lot of it's really just trying to, it's people skills and it's experience. But it's also curiosity. So I'm nosy, and I'm very.
Do you talk during these sessions?
Yeah, sometimes the person. Sometimes it's a bit of an issue because like the time is limited, and I'll end up just yapping, and then I'm like, "Oh, I better get this done." Like it's like that thing where I talk a lot before, but when I'm shooting, I really don't try to direct people that much, because I want to try and get a portrait. Say, for example, if it's a musician or if it's an actor, it's for me, I'm trying to like always explore these in-between moments, maybe where someone lets their guard down, or sometimes it's a moment where there's a sense of intimacy where ultimately it is, you've built a kind of level of trust where they feel like they can kind of
be themselves.
Yeah. And it's weird to describe, because it sounds like some weird smoke and mirrors thing, but it's not. A lot of it's just like putting people at ease and being able to like walk into a room and connect with someone or find common ground. That's something I always...
And patience, I guess, must be part of it. Even though you might be under the... You've got 3 minutes to get this shot, Rich.
Yeah. No, like the amount of pre-production that goes into things that people would never really think about. And you might have all the plans in the world for like some elaborate lighting setup, and then you turn up and you're like, right, go by that window. You've got like 2 minutes. We'll make it work. So that again, that's when experience kicks in. So. Yeah.
Well, congratulations on the award and the achievements to date, Rich, and delighted that it's given you the time to free up a little bit of space for the personal work, which must be hugely satisfying. And I presume the 11-year-old now, Robin, will be out in Blanchardstown with you for the opening.
She's going to be there with her sister, Simone.
So, there we go. Shout out to both of them. You better keep yourself on side.
I know.
Thanks to Rich Gilligan. Not at all. That's Rich Gilligan. And The First Draft is the title of the exhibition. It's at the Ground Floor Gallery in Drake from tomorrow, Wednesday. Is it tomorrow, Wednesday, 19th of February, or tomorrow
no,
week?
It opens tomorrow week.
Tomorrow week, Wednesday, the 19th of February, and it will be there through until Saturday, the 3rd of May. Full information on dreacht.ie. What happens when a leader wants all the power, none of the responsibility? Or when a patriarch succumbs to flattery over a more difficult truth? Shakespeare asks these questions and many more in King Lear, his study of political vacuums and family dynamics. The ageing king famously brings about his own downfall when at the start of the play he asks for a declaration of love from each of his three daughters in order to decide how he will divide up his kingdom. Roxana Silbert directs a new production at the Gate Theatre with Conleth Hill in the title role and Stuart Graham as the Earl of Gloucester and Fiona Bell as the Earl of Kent. Delighted that Roxana and Stuart are with me in studio this evening. Was it a play that had been there scraping at you for a long time, Roxana, that you said, this is one of the Shakespeare's I really want to get to direct? And of course, it's the named character who gives the play its title, which is a big part of it, I guess.
Yeah, I've loved this play. I read it at school, so it was part of what you would call your leaving cert. Mm. And so I've loved it since then, and I've seen a lot of productions of it. And I've had the fortune of working with Conleth a few times.
Conleth Hill, who's playing Lear, yeah.
Who's playing King Lear. So yes, it was a very happy coincidence that he was wanting to do it, and I was able to come on board.
And while watching all of those productions down all the years, was there no, not like that. That is not how I'm going to do it. I mean, was your vision of the play formed through not bad productions or anything, but through what you were seeing and liking and what you were seeing and thinking, no, I think there's something else there?
I think so. I think you always learn from seeing it. It's a really big play, but also it shapeshifts. So at different times of your life, you feel differently about it. So, you know, when you're young, you think that Cordelia is this sort of heroic character, and maybe that feels different when you come to it as an older person. But also the brilliant thing about Shakespeare is it means different things at different periods. And at this moment in time, I think the play is doing something really interesting about family, intergenerational relationships, abuses of power. So I think it just says different things at different times.
You, Stuart, are playing the character of Gloucester. Poor old Gloucester. What did he do to deserve this? He has his spoiler alert. He has his eyes plucked out.
He has his eyes plucked.
Is it Albany that does it, or the Cornwall? Cornwall, the other fella.
The other one.
The husband of one of Goneril and Regan. I can never remember which is which.
Regan.
He's the husband of Regan. Plucks out his eyes, but himself and Lear, there's a kind of a mirror image in some ways between the two of them, isn't there?
Yeah, I think so. I think very much Gloucester is dealing in his own household with many of the things that
he's the father of Edmund
and
Edgar.
Yeah. And so he has that story going on while also fielding what's happening in Lear's household. So he's, you know, he has a role within Lear's household, and he's watching those events occur while simultaneously fielding something in his own house that's not a million miles away from where. I mean, I believe that, you know, that originally they were two separate and distinct stories. The story of Lear and the story of the Gloucester family were two stories that Shakespeare decided to take
bring
and conjoin
together,
and bring the
yeah.
two together. And that was, you know, that was how that came about.
I mean, famously, people talk about kings divide his kingdom. He snubs his daughter. He goes mad. There's a storm. Then everyone dies. But a huge amount of stuff happens. You were saying, Roxana, in terms of, is it one of the longest plays? Certainly in terms of Lear, I think Lear is possibly the most lined character, if you like. He has the most lines to say in all of Shakespeare, or in a lot of the plays.
Lear is a massive part. I have to say we've edited down because if you run it without an edit, it's about 4 hours long, and I think we will be nowhere near that long. But it is it's a massive part. It's interesting that he gets a big old rest in Act Four, because the first three acts are really heavy on him.
Yeah, is Act Four then when all the Gloucester stuff is happening?
And yeah, a lot of it happens.
Edgar is out on the heath.
That's three, but Gloucester was blinded at the end of three, so four then is following
his
journey after that event, and as you know, as Roxana says, probably in the day it was to give the actor playing Lear a bit of a rest,
bit of a rest before you get into Act Five and the emotional aspect of Act Five, which is the huge bit, and all of those deaths which are on the way.
Multitudinous, yeah.
When it came to choosing. You talked about contemporary resonances, or Stuart, I think, mentioned contemporary resonances in the play. When it came to choosing where to set it, how to set it, how did you go about that and tease it in and out of this idea of the potential contemporary resonances, Roxanne?
Yeah. So the play is set 800 BC, and we've set it in a pagan period. And I think it's really important that it's pre-Christian because it's a world that doesn't have any rules really, and so it's trying to create its own rules. You've always got with Shakespeare, so it's a sort of invented pagan period because there are things that go on. I mean, like Cornwall didn't exist, Albany didn't exist in that period, but it does in Shakespeare's play. So you're always trying to sort of marry when the play is set, when the play was written, and the play now. And a lot of it we've tried to do visually. We've worked really hard with movement directors to kind of create a world, but it's like an imagined world. And then visually we've tried to find a way of marrying that pagan world with a contemporary world.
And I suppose it is one of the joys. We don't get stuck. If it was a more contemporary history or a closer history, we'd start getting bogged down. But that couldn't have happened. He wasn't alive at that time. She wasn't there at that time. They weren't in the same place at that time. But that also perhaps, Stuart, frees the play up to have contemporary resonances without putting a big rubber stamp on them. What sort of resonances, contemporary resonances, have you seen and felt in the playing of Gloucester and in the play itself?
I think that, well, I'll give you one specifically, but first of all, I think that generally, because Shakespeare deals with those big, you know, human values, that there are sources there that are universal sources that affect all of us. It's quite easy that they resonate with any given community at any given time. It's quite easy to take those. And they're evolving. They evolve all the time. And they were evolving at the time that they were first produced. Mm. That's the thing that people forget as well. When people talk about messing with Shakespeare, I don't think that really, you know, they messed with it. You know, you look at the first quarto and the first folio and the differences there and how they evolved at the time. So these pieces are constantly evolving. And it's those universal themes that keep them linked to every society at any time. And there are things that jump out in certain times. Like, for example, the specific that I'm going to give you is that Gloucester has a line in the play where he basically espouses quite a socialist viewpoint of the world.
Mm. And what does he say, if you don't mind my asking? sorry to put you on the spot, because maybe the exact line won't come to you.
Well, the end of the line is, so distribution should undo excess and each man have enough. And
could have been written by Karl Marx.
Exactly, exactly. And that, maybe it's the world that we're living in today or whatever, but for the first time, that leapt out at me. And whether that is to do with where we are in the socio-economic world right now, I don't know. I mean, the gulf between the haves and the have-nots does seem to be expanding in a way like it's never really done before. And that's something that really leapt out. But that's, you can find those moments the whole way through a Shakespearean text, just those things.
I think I was shortening her name to Roxanne. And it's Roxanna, in fact. Sorry, I beg your pardon for doing that, Roxanna. And in the directing and in the exploration of the piece, how much do you have to kind of sit back and let those things bubble up, as opposed to think, that's the line I want, that's the one I want, that's the one I want the audience to hear?
The thing is, it's so brilliantly written that if you play it truthfully, all those things jump out. I mean, it is a brilliant play about family as well. Yeah, it is. I'm working with actors in their 20s and they're all going, oh yeah, this is like my sister and me or my brother and I. You know, there isn't. It's extraordinary how that resonates across.
Well, there's a touch of Shakespeare. This is Shakespeare's Succession. There's a touch of that about it, isn't there, for sure?
Yeah, we were literally talking about that outside. Succession is absolutely a legacy of King Lear.
Yeah, and you can kind of see that there are times when, you know, King Lear isn't the nicest man in the world either to anybody. He's quite vain and quite nasty.
Well, a lot of people do terrible things in this play, and yet the way he writes the characters means that you still can find some compassion for them. And that is the brilliance in the writing. I mean, nobody behaves well in this play, really, apart from the doctor, who turns out to be very nice. But there's a lot of bad behaviour.
I mentioned in the introduction about Fiona Bell playing the Earl of Kent. You also have Hazel Clifford as Oswald. And that kind of gender shift in terms of those casting. What was your idea there? Or what did you want to get from that?
I think because it's set in a sort of pagan world, I was looking at these women, the sisters, sort of like Boudicceas. They're kind of warrior sisters. It's a warrior world. And so in that world, those earls and dames can be female. And it felt to me, I didn't really want her to play a man, but I felt because she was a woman who then had to pretend to be someone else, she could pretend to be a man, and that there was fun to be had in the idea of her passing as a man, and how that changed her relationship with Lear, and how that changed her relationship with Cordelia, particularly at the start. So I just think it opens some stuff up. I mean, of course, in Shakespeare, there would have been no women on stage.
Yeah.
So it's always interesting when you start mucking around with gender in Shakespeare.
And how would you describe, I was asking you just before we came to air, at what point you were in rehearsal. So you start your technical rehearsals, essentially you're in the rehearsal room for the rest of this week, then it's onto the stage working out the finer detail of lighting and sound and all of those technical cues that have to be done. Where you're seeing in terms of, because it is King Lear, that is the title of the play, in terms of what Connell Hill is doing now, what kind of Lear is coming out from him?
He
should close his ears now.
Yes, he needs. I mean, I've been gifted with an incredible cast. Everyone is brilliant. I think Connell Lear is very unique. There is... he can be very vicious, this Lear, but he can also be incredibly compassionate. And it was a little bit like Stuart was saying, there's also that moment for Lear when he suddenly realises that he has not taken care of the people he should have taken care of. But there is also humour in Lear. And I think that Conleth has been able to really capture some of those moments. And also that from his perspective, he's utterly heartbroken. And I think there's something very vulnerable, because this man who's had this enormous power and enormous energy is really heartbroken by the fact that his daughters don't appear to love him the way he thought they should. And yet he has no understanding of what he's done to contribute to that situation. And I think he's found all those nuances beautifully.
And I had asked Roxana at the top about when she first read the play. Was it a school play for you, Stuart? And was it a play that was always there in the back of your mind?
I think it was, yeah.
Something you wanted to approach?
Yeah, it was a play.
Had you played any of the, had you played in Edmund or in Edgar earlier?
No, it's not a play that I've tackled before. But it was a play that we studied at school, and it is a play that I've seen a number of productions of. I mean, there were various appeals for me to come and do. Gloucester has always had a place in my heart, and I've wanted to play him for a while, but getting the chance to come and play it with, you know, Conlith, who's been a friend of mine for many years, with Fiona, with, you know, with Roxana in the gate, it all just seemed to fall into place, and the appeal that I've never. I was talking to someone about this today. I've done plays in the past where I had I've been physically restrained in some way, or but I've never done something with one of my senses. I've been deprived of one of my senses, and I really wanted to experience that on stage, actually, and I'm enjoying it enormously.
Yeah, because you do spend a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Blindfolded at the very least. I don't know how much vision you have in that, or how much you've not allowed yourself to have vision.
I would like to have none. But unfortunately, we live in a health and safety world. So, and also on top of that, I wouldn't want to put the pressure on other actors to feel that they were completely responsible for where I was on the stage. They've got enough going on in their own head. They don't need to be dealing with me at the same time. So it would be selfish to ask that of them.
Well, listen, the best of luck with the production. As I say, that final week in the room before you head into the theatre. Both an exciting and a nerve-wracking time, I'm sure. Thanks both for coming in. That is Roxana Silbert, director. Stuart Graham, actor, playing the part of Gloucester in King Lear, which is at the Gate Theatre in Dublin. Previews from the 21st of February. It opens on the 26th. It runs through until Sunday, the April the 27th. And you'll get full details on gatetheatre.ie. For a period of years, the German Baroque composer Johann Sebastian Bach composed one cantata per week, a piece of music that was performed as part of the Lutheran Sunday service with the purpose of illuminating the message of that particular week's gospel. This was one element, just one element, of his role as director of music at the Church of St. Thomas in Leipzig. Of the hundreds of cantatas he wrote, 200 were preserved, but more than 100 are thought to have been lost to history. It was once a long-standing tradition of performing the selection of Bach cantatas in Dublin in the spring. It was revived by Palestrina Choir director Blanid Murphy and Therese Timoney from the Marlborough Baroque Orchestra recently. The series has been going on for the last two weekends and will conclude this weekend with one final performance on Sunday in St Anne's Church in Dublin with the Continuum Choir, the Marlborough Baroque Orchestra and soloist soprano Katie Kelly. Is she Katie or Cathy? Katie would be much better, wouldn't it? Alison Browner, alto, tenor Christopher Bowen and bass Benjamin Russell. Delighted that Blanid Murphy, who will be conducting the series, is with me in studio this evening. When you say out loud that Bach was composing one of these cantatas every week, along with a whole bundle of other stuff, you kind of wonder what was going on.
It was extraordinary.
In the man's head.
No, I mean, because he had to, not only did he compose them, he then had to get the scribes, had to write out the parts. They then had to be rehearsed with the boys of the Thomas Kirche and the school. He then had to perform the works. He wrote things depending on if there was a special instrumentalist he knew would be in Leipzig at a time. He made sure there was a bassoon part added or a special oboe part. So it was an extraordinary labour of love and of dedication of extraordinary levels.
Yeah, and I suppose we should explain what exactly a cantata is and how it fits into that Lutheran service.
Well, as director of music in Leipzig, he was expected to produce music, either bring music together or compose his own music that would illuminate the themes and the gospel of the particular Lutheran service of the day. So he took that role very, very seriously. And produced works, 6-7 movements, choruses, arias, recitatives, all with texts by well-known writers, hymn Lutheran hymn tune writers, and other librettists who helped to write the texts. And he became very well known, obviously, for his extraordinary theological understanding as well as his genius as a musician.
Well, of course, I think Bach was always very clear that it was for the glory of God. That was what he believed he was doing in the writing of his music. So the fact that it would have been linked into a religious service isn't a huge surprise.
No, and each of his works finished with the saying, Soli Deo Gloria, for you alone God the glory. Mm. And it was a very Lutheran reformist sentiment, and he fully embraced that.
While he would have been in Leipzig, or indeed in any of his other positions at certain times, would he still have been composing secular music, you know, his keyboard concertos, his instrumental concertos?
Now, some of them date from other periods of his life, but yes, he did. He wrote an awful lot of organ music, music for keyboards, all different types of stuff. So he was a man who was very busy, and on top of that, he was also in charge of the boys in the boarding school attached to the Lutheran church, and the family lived in the same building as the boarding school. So he was, and he had his own 20 children, so he was one busy man.
He was a busy man. Well, I suppose he was supplying some future players and singers,
yes, right.
for his later work. Now, I hope I have put the right one into the right place. I'm going to start with Cantata 140. You're doing Cantata 140 and Cantata 78, isn't it?
Yes.
Are the two that you're performing this coming Sunday. Because I think this particular movement is probably one of the more familiar pieces to many people. And that is the tenor aria, or one of the tenor arias from Cantata number 140 of Johann Sebastian Bach, so-called Sleepers Awake. And Bláthnaid Murphy, who is directing the performance of both Cantata number 140 and number 78 this coming Sunday at St Anne's Church in Dublin, is with me in studio this evening. It is a familiar, I think that tune would be very familiar to lots of people. Sleepers Awake. What particular part of the liturgical year was being celebrated here by Bach?
It was November, I think it was 25th of November 1731 that cantata was first performed, so into Advent, and it's about the ten virgins, and five have their lamps full and five are caught with them not ready, and it's the big thing about being ready and being prepared as the theme of Advent.
And one of the things that strikes me about these cantatas, they were, as we say, they fitted within the liturgical year and were part of a Lutheran service in the case of Bach. How exposed the soloists are. Yes, there are choruses and...
Extraordinarily exposed. And bearing in mind they were sung by boys, the soprano and alto parts. In those days, boys' voices didn't break till they were 17 or 18. So you did have a much more mature boy. But still, there was a great onus on you know, young people to produce the goods. And the tenor bass parts would have been also boys from the school who are now tenors and basses. So, and the instrumental writing is so tricky.
And who was playing the instrument? Like you were saying, yes, there might be visiting musicians and therefore he'd have a great oboe part in this particular performance because there was an oboe player in town.
Yes, no, there were resident people who played each week and they'd have got to know the style really well. But even so, there's virtuosic writing on an extraordinary level.
Yeah, I just want to bring in another movement from the cantata number 140, In Underneath Me, as I'm explaining here, because you were saying that it would have been played by, or No, sorry, I put the wrong one up there. It should be the other one that's up there, I think. The one that's up in block one, I think. There we go. That's the one. We can hear the kind of sorrowful tone in this particular piece. You were saying that this would have been sung by probably a very young boy.
Yes.
And an older boy.
Yes.
Obviously, for the sake of these performances and in the version we're about to hear, it's a soprano voice and a bass voice. That mix of the male and female, how different is that in contemporary terms than what we would have heard or would have been heard back in the day?
Well, Bach used that often, the bass to represent Christ or Jesus. Mm. And in this case, it's the soul, the soprano is the soul. And it's a Song of Songs sort of theme text of a love duet, really, between the Christ wooing the soul.
Yeah. Let's have a listen to the two voices then mixing in with each other. Part of the soprano bass duet there, soprano Hanna Blazlikova and bass Peter Kuji, the two singers in that performance from the cantata number 140 of Johann Sebastian Bach. And you were saying, Bláthnaid Murphy, as we were listening to that, even the violin playing underneath it is virtuosic as well.
Utterly virtuosic. And we're very fortunate to have Therese Timoney, who...
Yes, this is of the Marlborough Baroque Orchestra. Yeah. The other interesting thing, one of the other interesting things that is part of the performance this coming Sunday, the Continuum Choir are singing cantata number 78, and the great kind of meta aspect to this in some ways.
Yes, this choir is made up of former choristers, girl and boy choristers at the Pro Cathedral, and quite a few of them are doing the Leaving Cert this year, and of course cantata 78 is one of the set pieces, so I hope it's beneficial to them to be singing that piece.
And you were talking about the logistical difficulties. They are in the middle of mocks at the moment.
Some have mocks and some are on work placements, work experience. But anyway, that's life. So we just...
Yeah. I'll play a chorus from it because it will give us a sense of the nature of the choral music that Bach would have got within these cantatas as well. This is the opening movement from Bach, cantata number 78, Jesus, You Rescued My Soul. I think the opening chorus, in fact, from cantata number 78, which is the second of the two cantatas that will be performed this coming Sunday at St Anne's Church in Dublin with the Continuum Choir. The Continuum Choir, Bláthnaid Murphy, the director of this particular event, and also the Palestrina Choir in the Pro Cathedral in Dublin. The Continuum Choir are now teenagers during their leaving cert, as you explained, who had sung either as girl choristers or as boy choristers in Palestrina. That, as the name suggests, that continuation, how important was it for you to not to just lose total contact when they became teenagers?
Well, it was very important. When the first group of girls left the choir, they were really upset. And one of the mothers, Dee Moran, came and said, can we start a choir for these? It was girls then. Mm. And I said, OK, and we did with seven girls. And then suddenly one day, one boy showed up, or young teenage boy. Mm. And I was like, OK, that's a new dimension. And now it's flourishing. We have boys and girls from both the choirs, and they've had that training in, as you said, Palestrina and right through. So singing Bach is a relatively natural evolution, I think, for them.
Yeah, and actually I know there was somebody you specifically wanted to mention in the cantatas and getting these cantatas onto the stage, if that is the right term to use for St. Anne's Church.
Well, again, I always, in theory, wished to bring them back to life because I've been involved in the 10-year cycle in the beginning of the 2000s. But it was Jermaine Carlos, who had been manager of the choirs at the Pro-Cathedral, who really gave the push and who is the administrative and organisational mastermind behind the series. Mm. And that's fantastic. It's a great team of people, along with Niall Kinsler and Therese Timoney.
Yeah, and your Sunday job, as it were, is with the Palestrina Choir in the Pro-Cathedral. The quincentennial of Palestrina's this year.
Yes.
That, I presume, will lead to a lot of performance of his music throughout the year from the choir.
Yes, we're singing some of his music every week. And already I can notice how the boys have flourished in the style and become much more confident readers and very comfortable in that style. Of course, we already sang quite a lot of it, but we're doing some every single week at the moment.
And the other aspect, you talked there about that natural movement from that Palestrina to Bach. Mm. In terms of music, what is the shift from Palestrina to Bach? Palestrina was writing, I suppose, sacred music for the Catholic Church, Bach very much for the Lutheran tradition.
Well, they're both very contrapuntal, I suppose, differently. But I think young people sing Bach very easily. Their voices are very flexible. And they have, especially having had the Palestrina background, they know how to lead lines and how to be confident holding a line against another part. So I think they were quite complementary, even though they're quite different as well.
Yeah, they're very different in terms of compositional style. Mm. Who is Palestrina slightly earlier?
Yes, he would be a good almost 200 years earlier. Mm. So he's the real Renaissance composer, polyphony, and Bach, I suppose, took a lot from that style and is a master of counterpoint and master of fugal and contrapuntal writing.
Yeah, well, one thing grows out of the other, I suppose, as continuum grew out of Palestrina. And I hear the Palestrina regularly, and I must say I'm still amazed what you can do every Sunday with those choirs. But thanks for coming in to us this evening, Blondet. And let me just give the full details of the final concert of the Dublin Bach Cantata series. Takes place this Sunday, that is the 16th of February, at St. Anne's Church in Dublin. Tickets and information on eventbrite.ie. But that is our lot for this Tuesday evening. Research this evening was by Leah Murphy. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Niall McMonagall was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. John Crean will be with you after the news.